This is Rainmaker FM, the Digital Marketing Podcast Network. It's built on the Rainmaker platform, which empowers you to build your own digital marketing and sales platform. Start your free 14-day trial at rainmakerplatform.com. Hello, and welcome to the Digital CMO Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Oren, here on the Rainmaker.fm network. And today I have a guest that I think most people when I started the podcast weren't asking if, but when I would have Hugh on, because he is a good friend and one of my media and marketing heroes. And I try and have a little bit of Hugh in everything we do, from the art hanging in my office to actually have a tattoo of one of his pieces. So today we have Hugh McLeod of Gaping Void. Gaping Void is a consultancy and I'll let Hugh explain better, but you know, it all starts with visuals and art and a business built around changing cultures and making cultures better. Their clients include, and this is just a few, companies like Cisco, Havas, Intel, Zappos, Rackspace, Citrix. I could go on and on and on. And Hugh also is an author. He has three books, Ignore Everybody, Evil Plans, and Freedom is Blogging in Your Underwear. I think you'll get the vibe. And by the way, all listeners should at this point, if you don't know who Hugh is, go to gapingvoid.com and check out his art and get the vibe before you go any further. Without further ado, welcome, Hugh.
Hey, Mike, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. I'm thrilled you're here. Why don't we start by, you know, since we're talking to an audience of corporate marketers here, start by telling a little bit about what Gaping Void is, what you do, and how culture, in the end, somehow relates to marketing and selling product.
Yeah. Well, I'm a co-founder and lead artist and lead writer at Gaping Void, and we're a culture consultancy that does what we call culture design, whereas we use art to affect behaviors and kind of spread ideas within organizations in order to stir things up, I suppose. So we're not just to inspire people, but also to have like little objects in the organization they can have to start conversations around. So we basically create stuff to make people talk about important stuff around the water cooler, basically.
Let me give a mini testimonial. I'll give a couple examples of how we've seen that work in practice at Speakeasy. So I have one of your pieces that is with your usual kind of monster characters, and it says, mediocre companies have teams, great companies have tribes. And I kind of wordlessly put that up in our conference room when we started Speakeasy. Didn't really, you know, make a big deal out of it, didn't make a speech about it or a blog post or anything. And next thing I knew, just organically, I saw people start referring to our team as the tribe, and our all company email became tribe@our
domain. Exactly. And I got the tribes idea from Seth Godin, of course, but it's a way of signaling inside organizations kind of, behaviors or values or purposes that we're hoping to, you know, instill inside organizations. And art's a powerful tool. I mean, look at what the Romans did. They built big statues or look at the Roman Catholic Church. They, you know, do these big-ass badass murals about what's there to fear, what's there to love, what's there to revere, you know, what's important. And I think art's a really great way of condensing to
right.
easily
and for those,
form what's important.
Absolutely. And for those who haven't seen the art, you know, I always describe it to folks as cynically hopeful, which I guess is another way of saying honest. But you know, this is not like those horrible successories that have platitudes and stock photos,
no.
Right?
No. They have my kind of like slightly deranged, kind of abstract, semi-cartoon style, which I've had for the last 25 years. I mean, a good example is one I did for Rackspace. It just said, if you're just here for the paycheck, don't expect to last very long. And of course, the people who are just there for the paycheck hate that cartoon. And the people who are there for like some kind of higher purpose love that cartoon. And by seeing the way people interact with that cartoon, the managers know what side their team is on, or what team their side is on, whatever.
Right.
It's a way of signaling behaviors. It's a way of changing behaviors. It's very subtle, but when it works, it's very powerful. We did another one for Microsoft just a few years ago. It said, change the world or go home, which is like, that's why we work for Microsoft. We're not here because we can make a lot of money. We want to make a lot of money. We go work for someone else. I mean, they get paid there, but they're not driven to work at Microsoft because the pay is that great. I mean, it's not bad, but if they really want to make money, they'd go work for an evil bank or something. But they want to, they want to make software that really changes the world, that really makes an impact, and that's what motivates them. I did another one for Microsoft. It said the freakier we get, the better we get. In other words, their culture, what keeps their culture alive is their kind of all those kind of weird 180 IQ freaks that have working for them. The quasi Nobel laureates, the particle physicists, the guys working on quantum computers. It's not just the guys making and selling Windows Office. It's those guys in the deep research who are just like thinking about really freaky stuff that the world might need in a year's time. And they have a very vibrant culture that inside Microsoft that most of the world doesn't get to see, but is also a very vital part of their culture. And that's what makes Microsoft special. That's why they're still in business, even though everybody's been calling them dead for the last 15 years. They're anything but dead.
Right.
So I guess I was an artist, and before that I was in advertising. And when I worked in that, I was a writer when I was in the advertising business, and I just noticed that the companies were more interesting than their products. In other words, their culture and their purpose was like really could be really interesting, even if their products were like $3.99 at any supermarket. And I was kind of going, well, what is it that makes companies want to do what they're doing? What's the reason? Why bother?
Right. Well, so how often do you go in, when you go into a company? How often is it that you go in and find that their purpose, their culture, what makes them unique, has little bearing to what they thought it was when you came in the door? Or is it a big surprise? Or are you just ratifying what they know?
Some are less surprising than others. Let's put it that way. And some are more surprising. I mean, there are some companies that do really wonderful PR, but then when you get there, you realize everybody hates each other.
Right.
And then, to be fair on everybody, I mean, all companies over a certain size have cultural problems because they're big and they're lots of people and people are messy and, they have a lot to lose because there's lots of money involved and money makes people messy and people make people messy and it's very, and they also have the innovator's dilemma where, what worked 10 years ago may not work in another 10 years, but they still have to keep on cranking out the stuff from 10 years ago, and how do they evolve without losing their grip on what's actually making the money? And so generally, I'm not saying people don't call us unless they have a problem, but they don't call us unless they realize that this stuff's important.
Right.
Because not all companies think they have a problem. Other companies go, we pay them. They should be glad. And okay, all right, well, good luck. We can't do anything for
right.
them. But
I'm sorry, go ahead, you.
And so, I mean, the good thing about, and your job is like this too. I mean, the good thing about your job is like you get all these different companies, and they all have these kind of different issues. And that way, every time you get a new assignment, you get to look at the world differently. So
that's very differently.
Yeah, but they all, so it's not like, 25% of my client base does X and 35 does this. We had one engagement with a very large client recently. And we have a consultancy, so we go in and we get data. It's not just like an artist, you or me, being creative. We have a pretty capable team. We go in there, we do focus groups, we dig around. And what we came up with was, this thing says, well, basically every last employee of yours wants to be amazing. The only trouble is they have X, Y, and Z getting in their way. Now, I won't say what's getting in their way because then everybody will know who I'm talking about.
Right. But, we're protecting the guilty.
Well, you got to be a little bit discreet nowadays.
Right.
When you're a consultant. But the thing is, at least you have a company that wants to do the right thing. So all you have to do is ask yourself, well, what is that right thing? Does it actually exist? Is it actually meaningful for us? And so when we think about performance, we think of it in terms of a dialogue of meaning, because that's what gets people up. That's what people gets people up out of bed in the morning is like this stuff matters, or else we'll just go become fry cooks at Wendy's or something, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I always tell our people, you know, when they're having existential angst about what we do, I say, well, it beats digging ditches. And now let's make it mean more than that. So you talk about companies that already get it and know that either they have a problem or that this is something important they need to reinforce. And so I've seen you guys work a lot with, you know, companies like Zappos and people who are sort of techie and on the edge. But I know lately you've been doing a lot in the healthcare space. Tell me about how came about and how that's different.
Well, healthcare is interesting because, well, we're in South Florida. We're based in Miami, and that's a big healthcare spot because of, you know, all the snowbirds. And it's a big, big, big part of the economy here. It's like oil. The oil business in Houston is the same kind of prominence. Well, the thing about healthcare is it's very expensive. It's very bureaucratic. It's very intense because, you know, people suffer and die and bad things happen. You got a lot of government regulation. You've got a lot of the reasons that doctors, for example, went into medicine have eroded. In other words, the money and their respectability aren't what they were a generation ago. At the same time, you have a growing business because people are getting older. That means, you know, that means the industry is getting bigger because the older you get, the more expensive medicine gets. That's just the way. That's just nature. And you have these big impersonal hospitals. Who wants to get really sick and go see a doctor? You know, sit in a hospital bed and go, yeah, you're a goner. Sorry. Tell your wife. You know, it can be very intense, very grim place. And, you know, these poor doctors have to, like, you know, a doctor will see 50 people a day, and, like, a lot of them are not long for this world. And they have to deal with this. They have to maintain this empathy. And so culturally, these because it's so stressful, the doctors often, or the team, or so to say, the organization often forgets why they're doing it because they're so stressed out all the time. There's always something going wrong. There's always somebody dying who shouldn't be dying, you know. And it's just, and we thought, you know, if we could help make hospitals more aligned to or more articulate with their purpose and their vision and their, you know, why this stuff matters and why it should be interesting to other people, then we could actually help create a lot of value and in a very short period of time, which is kind of what's starting to happen. For example, I mean, here's a little one, right? South Florida Physicians Group here in Miami. We put a bunch of art in their office, and designed to make people laugh, you know, all this kind of, you know, upbeat stuff. And people would laugh, and all of a sudden, if they're in a good mood, it'd be easier for people to, like, step on scales or to, like, take their pants off or stuff like that. Just little things made, you know, people are much easier to deal with when they're happier than when they're miserable, you know. And just from that.
Even just sharing a laugh and treating somebody like a person. I know
I go
to a couple different doctor's offices, and one of them, they're very formal and very, you know, they're very serious. And they're probably, you know, technically, and in terms of the education they have, better doctors than this other office I go to, where they smile, they laugh, they remember me, they ask how I am, and I come out of there feeling better, even though I may not have had the same background and skills. I'm probably still getting what would be considered better care, and I think people forget that in the medical space.
Yeah, and so you'll be less likely to cancel appointments, you'll be more likely to take your medicine, you'll be more likely to refer a friend. Anyways, to make a long story short, just by putting that art up on the wall, we increased the traffic flow through that office by 17%.
Yeah. Wow.
No other changes.
That was the only difference.
That. Yeah, yeah. Just because we walk in, all of a sudden, we have all this happy art everywhere that's kind of like on message. Like, we did this one cartoon right by this. You know how when you go to the doctor, they weigh you every time?
Right.
And when you're at my age and when you're your age, you know what you do. You go, oh, God, day of reckoning. So we did this, I put this cartoon that just said, hey, remember when all the old fat people were still older and fatter than you are? I know, right? You know? And people get a chuckle out of that because, you know, it's a human condition, you know.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the a lot more people were getting on the scale. And see, every time a person refuses to get on the scale because they're too embarrassed about their weight, that costs the doctor about $300. You do that a couple of times a day from that one, you know, you can cut that down just by making them laugh a little bit.
Right. The time they'd save with me, where I'm usually taking off my shoes and taking my wallet and my keys and my phone and everything that has any weight to it and trying to, get rid of it before I get on the scale. Yeah. If I'm laughing too hard to do that, they've already saved 30 seconds.
Well, if you're dragging your feet from one room to the next, you go, oh, God, here I go to die. if you've ever been really sick, I mean, sitting in those doctor's offices, waiting for the nurse to come in and say, we've ordered your coffin, sir. it's pretty grim in a doctor's office, especially, if the news is bad. But, I think humanizing the medical profession, making it kind of, giving it a little, because, so much of the medical profession, you've ever been to a medical trade show, it's just like, big banners to say, a revolution in bedpans. No, what was the tagline? Join the bedpan revolution, and a big 4-foot banner photograph of a bedpan. That's about as creative as these environments get. The bedpan revolution.
Right. There's a word you use there that I think that is important, and it's an overlaps with something that we talk about a lot, and that's humanizing. Because work and these businesses, whether it's healthcare or whatever else, they're inherently human, right? They're being done by humans, but we lose that, and it becomes this machine, and you forget that. And that's why, we do a lot of video for clients that we actually call these, we tag them in our system as humanizing. That the dude at the other end of the phone has a wife and he has kids and he's not getting home to them right now because he's trying to help you with, whatever your problem is, and he has interests outside, and he actually also really knows what he's doing, and he's disappointed when he's unable to help you. And all of a sudden, that makes people go from, screaming and cursing and posting horrible things on social media to saying, it's funny, when you see reviews of any business, most of the time if they're positive, they don't say business name helped me. They say George helped me.
Right.
Sally helped me. And this is the same thing.
And also for the CMO out there listening, we live in a time of what I call peak content. In other words, we're already blasted with every single sales message imaginable. In fact, that was true 100 years ago. It was really true 50 years ago. It was really, 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 really true 20 years ago. And my God, it's hyper-real true right now. And, Seneca used to complain about too many messages out there. And that was like the first century AD. There's just too much shit out there. But the thing that doesn't scale is that kind of human longing to connect, to feel alive. We have infinite need for that. We need to matter. We need to feel that we're part of some kind of meaningful cosmic dance. And some companies are better at articulating that or understanding that than others. Other people just want, other companies just want your money. And you get this because I see a lot of social media out there on Twitter. I like watching Twitter. I don't know. And there's some nice, well-intentioned 22-year-olds twittering on behalf of a client for let's say some ice cream and say, wow, it's really hot in Miami today. A perfect reason to go out and get yourself brand X ice cream. Yay. Oh, today's Wednesday. A great excuse to go out and get yourself some brand X, ice cream. And then by the end of the week, you're so sick of hearing the same platitudinous, thinly disguised pitch that you kind of go, why are you doing this? Why is anybody paying you? Whereas what people really want is they want interesting stuff, and they want interesting people in their lives.
It's funny. You bring up ice cream. I'll give a good example of that. So, and what you're describing, I call it the crummy commercial phenomenon for anybody who's ever seen A Christmas Story, and he does the Little Orphan Annie decoder ring, and, in the end, it just tells him to drink more Ovaltine, and he's, it's a crummy commercial. But so here's a counterexample. So what could you do that's meaningful? And a lot of times, you have to tell businesses that, the best way to tell an interesting story is to have an interesting story, which seems very obvious, but it's not. But so you take your ice cream example, buy our ice cream, buy our ice cream, who cares? There's a friend of mine in Dallas who just opened a new sort of first in a hopefully a chain of ice cream places. Well, here's what his story is their place is entirely staffed with special needs people. Everybody who works there is a special needs person who likely would have trouble finding a job elsewhere, and that's what they believe in, and that's what's important. And they also make great ice cream. Well, now, oh my gosh, how many stories can they tell? And then somewhere else in town, there is a, commodity ice cream maker saying, well, why is this guy getting in the newspaper, and why are people posting videos from his place on social media? Well, because that's a human story we all care about.
You know, he's doing a great job with that. It's Microsoft. Sorry, one of the clients. I'm not associated with the project, but the Microsoft Instagram right now is really great because instead of saying, you know, here's Windows 10, buy some Windows 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, you know, yay, 10. They're just like profiling these really amazing people doing really crazy stuff, really amazing stuff, who are, you know, using Windows computers, but that's not what makes the photograph interesting. What's interesting is, like, you know, somebody's, like, turning a dilapidated building in Detroit into a ballet theater or something, you know, like...
Right.
And, or figuring out how to bring fresh water to some godforsaken hellhole in the third world, you know, for, you know, 20 cents on the dollar. You know, just really interesting people doing really interesting things who would not be able to do it without Microsoft stuff.
Exactly. And Apple's always been the king of that, to just sort of show off the people and the users and their experience more so than here's a box that has some gears in it and does some things.
Yes, yes. Or saying, here, it's got, our chip is 30% bigger. You too can
right.
be 30% bigger than all the other guys, you know. and actually, you know, staying away from, stop talking about yourself, you know. I mean, the way to be interesting is
right.
talk about other people, you know. And,
right. So now, I'm sorry, I want to get on one other thing before we have to do the quick break here. A lot of what you do, it sounds like, starts with the human resource department. It starts with, like, internal culture.
We do a lot of HR, yeah.
Right. But what I'm seeing, and I know this happens in your business, and I want you to talk about it, but we're seeing even more and more the connection where particularly businesses with heavy customer interaction and that have heavy customer service or sales, you know, it's really they're finding that connection between culture and HR and marketing is inextricable. And like we've got a client that I know just appointed a vice president of internal marketing.
Right.
How does a good or a crummy culture impact a business's ability to market?
Oh boy, where do you want me to start? I think a good example is like Rackspace, which has a very strong ethos of what they call fanatical support, which means, you know, we go the extra mile to make sure you're happy. In fact, that's our major selling point over the other guys in the cloud hosting service. In fact, they don't even really host the cloud anymore. They let Amazon do it, but they just put a kind of human layer on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their killer app, and that's what people talk about, you know. And then then the people using it tell their friends, and then it spreads. As opposed to, I mean, Rackspace does advertising, and they, you know, they do the occasional billboard, but they didn't really, you know, do the occasional internet video, but they don't really do that much external stuff. Social media, I see them do a lot of. If somebody has a problem, you know, they have a team where they see somebody complaining on social media, they get on it. They go, sorry, here, call me. And even, you know, even Rob Legess, you know, the head of it, he says, here's my personal phone number, and it's his real phone number. You have a problem, you talk to me, and I'll sort it out. And then he's got a troubleshooting team that sorts them out, because the last thing he wants is some, you know, some angry person in Indiana raising Cain. And he'll do that for a small, like a $20 customer, he'll do that for $1 million customer. They're very kind of agnostic that way. It's very good. And that's part of their
right.
ethos. Now, if they started doing these kind of Super Bowl ads about how wonderful they are, I don't think it would work so well. I think their marketing is in the doing, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. In fact, the work itself is marketing. I mean, if there's
yeah.
probably no better marketing than delivering on your product or service and doing it in a way that makes people feel good about it.
Yeah. Or there's also like other kind of neat, like Zappos, another client come to mind a couple of years ago. They started putting stickers in the bottom of TSA trays, you know, where you enter your put your stuff on for the X-ray machines in airports.
Yeah, yeah.
And it said, you know, something like, wow, from here it looks like you could use a new pair of shoes, because, you know, you had to put your shoes. and they're kind of like fun little stickers. And it wasn't so much, here's why you should buy us or whatever, or use us. More like, yeah, we're trying to have some fun here. How about you? You know what I mean? It's kind of like an invitation to engage rather than here's why you should buy our stuff.
Like, right.
Here's a pretty, you know, pretty unpleasant shoe situation that we're trying to have a little bit of fun with. What about, you know, to lighten up a little bit. And that's that shows a degree of insightfulness and empathy, which are, you know, the two things that drive what we do for a living. So.
Well, it takes away from being a commodity. There's a certain expectation with certain types of businesses. I'm going to get certain types of things. When I get on the phone with somebody at a finance company, they're going to read me the legal terms of service. And if somebody does something that breaks that, that in itself tells you something about the company you're dealing with, that they're going to think outside the box and do things differently.
Well, when you think about it, Zappos is just a call center and a warehouse. They got telephones and they got shoes in a warehouse. And a very big account with UPS. That's all. I mean, they're your typical kind of call center, but they do differently, and that's what gives them their edge. They don't have these kind of like faceless drones who hate their jobs, like droning on the phone, like reading from a script. They have real human beings and trying to engage with these people.
Right.
And that's, again, that's marketing through doing rather than marketing through message, I suppose.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, so Hugh, let's take a quick break now, and then we're going to come back and talk about some specific marketing tactics that I've seen you opining about, as you are wont to do, and I have some thoughts too. So I want to get specific on that. But first, we're going to take a quick break here, and we will be right back with Hugh McLeod of Gaping Void. The Digital CMO Podcast is brought to you by Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing and sales podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm. Welcome back to the Digital CMO Podcast on the Rainmaker.fm network. I'm your host, Mike Oren, and I am here with Hugh McLeod of Gaping Void. We've been talking about culture and marketing and how the two interact and how something like art can almost single-handedly change culture. But we're going to shift gears a little bit now. As I've been reading a lot of year-end prognostications, one of the things that I've seen people talking about in the new year is that the hot, new, amazing, fresh marketing tool that everybody should be jumping on board with is email, which we have had for probably longer than any other digital tool, and that we alternately live in and curse for spam. And while I knew I would always have Hugh on the show probably multiple times before we're done with this, but this week I saw Hugh ringing in on that a little bit, and I always pay attention to what Hugh thinks with email, because for one thing, I know that of all the emails out there, the only daily email that I allow into my inbox is Gaping Void's daily email. The only other thing that hits my inbox daily is from unroll.me, which is an aggregation of all of the other newsletters I get so that I can scan quickly and see if I want to read. So, Hugh, how is it that email, our oldest digital tool, is suddenly the hot, fresh, new marketing tactic?
Well, two reasons. When I started blogging in like 2001, there were fewer bloggers in the regular bloggers in the world than are now currently working for Arianna Huffington.
Right.
You know, no, seriously. I mean, there was a couple of thousand bloggers back then. I think Huffington has about 10,000 bloggers on her list, on her contribution list. So, basically, the blogosphere turned into kind of content blizzard, and then. And then when Facebook came along, it made it even more blizzardy, you know, with now you just have to just push a button and just share the latest news story. So it's kind of like the whole internet has become like one, if everybody's on Facebook, everybody's become like this one big round robin. Secondly, and I mean, I like Facebook, I like mattering to my friends and everything, but I mean, in terms of spreading ideas, you have very little control over that, mainly because you're sending out one more snowflake in the blizzard, and also, you know, it's totally arbitrary whether Mark Zuckerberg decides you can share that with other people or not. So you don't really have any control over it. Whereas, you know, with an email, and you know, email is not perfect by any means, but you kind of know what you got to work with. You know, you got X thousand people, you know, listening to you every day. Work with that. And so it seems like a real personal connection as opposed to a kind of digital crapshoot, I suppose. And then, you know, your FM partner, you know, Brian Clark, talks about digital sharecropping. You know, if somebody else owns the content, then, you know, you can be taken out anytime you want. And we just feel like a lot of control and ownership with email, and we also feel like the people who really care about us enough to hear from us every day are the ones we want to be talking to. We don't run our business with people who just like stumble in by accident and they go, yeah, here's $1 million. That doesn't happen. It's the ones who we've built a permission asset over like many years. Somebody like yourself who's been following, you know, you've been following me for many years, and then we got to know each other.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, so you tend to have avid fans. It's not people who will either see your stuff float by them, I think, in a social stream and think, oh, there's some piece of weird art and move on, or they're a passionate fan and they say they can tell that's a gaping void piece and I want to see what he's thinking about today.
Right. Right.
And you can reach those people day in and day out.
Exactly. And those are the people obviously we care about everybody, but I mean, I have a personal connection with those people, certainly. And you feel like you're not trying to make it go viral, quote unquote. You're trying to make it connect right there and then one on one. Like that. I also like the feel. It's not like, and then you build it over time. You know,
right.
you know, sometimes people unsubscribe because, you know, they got sick of you. But that puts a fire under your bum, and so you can do something about that.
Right. But it also gives you a chance to go deeper. I'm seeing a lot now of email newsletters, and even though they may be content-driven, they're ultimately there to sell you something. And you've got something like, you know, Dave Pell's Next Draft that every day you can kind of rely on to give you the three or four stories you're going to want to care about in a voice you care about. Or
yeah.
You know, one I'm still trying to figure out, but I've seen recently that the Dollar Shave Club guys that everybody thinks of as the social media poster child have launched an email newsletter, and it's kind of news featurey and has nothing to do with shaving yet. But again, once they're in your inbox, it's there, and it's less ephemeral too, because the social media post, if you don't engage with it now, it's probably gone.
Right.
Unless you're a really sophisticated user, versus the email where I can say, oh yeah, that's important, I want to look at that later.
And you have to do, and the thing is, you have to, and even though everyone is inundated, I mean, the thing about the gaping void email, you get it once a day, okay? It's not like Facebook where you have to check it every 5 minutes, you know? It's just like one thing, and hopefully you can make it meaningful.
Right.
I think so I'm a big fan. Now, you know, there's a ratio between, you know, how big your audience has to be for you to reach critical mass so you can make a living. I know a guy, he's a tailor in England, and he makes 100 suits a year. He makes them by hand. He charges an arm and a leg for each one of them. But he only can sell 100 a year, because that's all he can make. And so he only needs 100 subscribers to his email. I mean, he got
right.
a couple of thousand.
Or maybe 1,000, because he's going to have, you know, a 10% sell-through.
I mean, he has many thousands, and he's got a very, very, very long waiting list. But the thing is, you know, if he's selling suits at $5,000 a pop, then he only really needs to get you to buy something for $20. You know, you're selling a pretty substantial piece
right.
of kit. So our model works. The email model works. You know, I think it's really hard to have a very large audience. And what makes a large audience? I mean, you can have a good audience. That's within your control. But whether it gets a mega huge is kind of out of your control in many ways. So,
well, and I think it's whether it's email or social,
yeah.
or even, you know, advertising. Whether you're going on a big network or a small network, I think the question is do you want to reach 3 million people who don't care, or 3,000 people who are likely buyers? And I don't know a marketer who wouldn't pick the 3,000 likely buyers over the 3 million who don't care. But
right.
we have this temptation to get into a numbers game and go
right.
big. And I think social has encouraged that. But, you know, I get frustrated when people, as we all humans tend to do, try and turn this into a zero-sum game, and it's email versus social, right? It was like, you
right,
know,
right.
blogs versus traditional media, web versus apps. It's not really blogs versus social. I mean, we really preach that one of the main purposes of social is to give somebody that sample to engage them and bring them back to your website so that they can sign up for your email. And one of the major measures of whether or not,
yeah.
as a brand, your social is working should be email signups and turning those 3 million into 3,000 who are likely to buy.
Right. I mean, we're kind of both in social media and email. I mean, we're not really. I mean, yeah, we sell art over the internet. I mean, we sell a lot of art over the internet, but we're not really. That's not the main thrust of the business. The main thrust of the business is, you know, we're looking for interesting people we can talk to.
Right.
And then you know, some of it will turn into business. But and that's the great. And that's if you go with that, saying, you know, we're doing this really neat thing. You're doing this neat little thing. Hey, let's hang out. And then of course, it's funny because when my friend the tailor did his blog, right? It was me who got him to blog. He became the blogging tailor. This was back in 2004, 2005.
You know, right, back in the dark ages.
Yeah, the blogger says, why do you want to? This will never work because most bloggers now are techies, and techies don't wear suits. So, well, that may be, but every techie has a brother or an uncle or a cousin who's a lawyer in New York, or has a friend who's a banker in New York.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has a cousin Robert who made a lot of money in Frankfurt or something, and those are the kind of guys who wear suits. And so if you know that guy, you'll say, hey, check this out. So mm-hmm. it wasn't really trying to sell anybody reading that a suit. It was more of a kind of, hey, if you know somebody interesting, could you tell your friends if you know them? You know, just drop them a line. But, you know, at the same time, we were trying to make the tailoring blog as interesting, so interesting that even people who didn't wear suits want to read it, if that makes any sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
because a lot of geeks, they may not be into suits, but they're into they may be into kind of the geekery of the craft, which is very, very geeky. You know, it takes 10 years of apprenticing just to be a tailor. You have to be very, very good.
Right. I think that was the early days of. I mean, you were in some ways on the vanguard of now. I mean, it almost is to the point of absurdity. I can't buy anything that doesn't have a story attached to it. Right.
Right.
You know, every site is rife with these long stories, and a lot of them are really good. And it's sort of says that there's two ways you can sell product. You can either be a commodity and sell it as cheap as possible, at as high a volume as possible, and be a machine, or you can have something unique that has a story to it, and that story may even just be the people who touch it, and then sell it at a premium. And that business to me is always more interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, there are these kind of like websites that do the whole faux kind of enlightened guru businessmen kind of, you know, hippie kind of authentic hipster. Aren't I clever? Kind of guy. Those ones drive me crazy. I don't need any more authenticity in my life. Well, that's not true. But you know what I mean. I mean anything can be overdone and overused and copied and done to death. I mean, I think this whole. But you know, I think there's a kind of. I think people. Everybody has their own like inner narrative, and they want products in their lives that make their inner narrative more credible somehow to themselves and to the world.
Mm. Well, so that would kind of suggest almost an echo chamber that a lot of people have accused social of becoming, of where you only get your news from social and you only follow people who agree with what you say. Is email an extension of that, or do you think you can find ways to challenge your audience without losing them?
I think the secret is talking about interesting stuff that has nothing to do with the business you're in, I guess. I don't know. I'd much rather talk about, my last email I wrote for the email, I didn't write about, you know, what we sell or anything or what I make or art or anything. I talked about this pizza joint out in West Texas who got evicted from their place, and they didn't have money to build their own place, so they crowdfunded it on Kickstarter, which to me was great, because instead of like Kickstarter like crowdfunding a hipster kind of gadget or something like that, it was like a mom and pop business doing it, and I thought it was like really interesting, so I wrote about that.
Yeah.
So
crowdfunding fascinates me in a lot of ways, and one of them is that in a lot of cases I feel like the crowdfunding is being done not as a means of gaining funds, but in and of itself as a means of marketing. Right.
Oh, sure.
It's like how do you launch a product without it having been on Indiegogo? And don't get me wrong, I love Indiegogo, and we've actually done Indiegogo campaigns for clients, but I see a lot of businesses there that, I mean, it's kind of, well, I'm fully funded and I'm cranking out product, but here's my Indiegogo.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. When I was in the wine business, doing kind of all kinds of early days of wine business, we tried to we started sponsoring flash mobs. We started bringing wine along to flash mobs because it was craziest thing that anyone could do in the wine business was, hey, let's sponsor a flash mob, you know,
right.
turn up a flash mob with bottles of free, you know, with bottles of wine for people to drink, you know.
Of the ways to gather a flash mob, I would think that would be one of the easier ones.
Yeah, well, no, we didn't turn up saying, hey, we're going to be sponsored. We just would turn up and then with our video camera. I mean, this was 10 years ago.
Right.
But the thing is, but then, you know, what happens is, like, next thing you know, somebody at Gray Advertising gets a memo from some brand manager saying, hey, these crazy kids are doing flash mobs. Why don't you send 400 people down there to the next flash mob? And then next thing you know, you have, like, more marketing execs there at the flash mob than actual flash mobbers. You know how it goes.
Right, right. We demand you make it more organic.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like, I mean, good ideas in social media tend to get saturated really quickly. So
yep.
the thing you can do, I think, is to get really bored of good ideas really quickly.
That's very, very smart. Get bored of good ideas really quickly.
Yeah.
So that you can have more of them.
Well, yeah, that way you're moving on. Well, everybody else is, like, you know, piling into Instagram or whatever, Pinterest, you know. Because you got to remember, I mean, since I left advertising a decade ago, or more than that even, I mean, a lot of these advertising agencies have turned into these kind of, like, content farms where, you know, you got these little kids who, you know, used to work for the Huffington Post, you know, now work for an ad agency, and they're just making content marketing, and they're just trying to think of, and it's a sea of stuff, and if they're all doing that, then you don't want to be doing that, because, you know, they're 26 and not making a lot of money, and that's going to be you.
There's an army of them, right? Yeah.
There's an army of them, and I mean, God bless them. But it's like, these good ideas, like, you know, like Instagram is a marketing tool. It's only how old is that idea? Like 2 years?
I mean, give or take. Yeah.
Yeah, it's already boring. You know.
One of the determinants of whether it's boring is whether it works or not, and that's something that I've had to learn in social, because there are networks that I'm personally not a fan of, that I don't use very much, that are great for our clients. We had folks that I told them they were complete fools to get on Pinterest when they weren't, you know, basically selling pretty retail baubles. And next thing I know, the number one driver of traffic to their website in social was Pinterest. In one way, you've got to get bored of the good ideas really quickly, and you've got to be open to the bad ideas, because...
You've got to test a lot of ideas, too. You've got to do A-B testing. You've got to go, oh, this might work. We've tried a lot of ideas. We've tried a lot of ideas over the years, so we're always experimenting with new ideas.
What's your favorite idea that didn't work?
They've all worked. No. I think we were hoping that Facebook would drive more business to us, but I don't think people go to Facebook to shop somehow, you know? So.
Right. Right. Or, you know, I think like your Facebook, I think, works for your as a stream of consciousness for the people who are your diehard fans, right? Like I follow you on Facebook, I follow you on Twitter. I don't feel like I have to go to your page and see every single post, but
no.
I know that it's going to be there, and it's going to provide me a little spark or a little thought at some point during the day. And what I count on is the email. And I think that may be a good analogy for how a lot of brands can deal with their enthusiasts. You know, the Facebook and Twitter is a little blip, it's a little ad, it's a reminder, and then let's get in some depth with the less transient communication.
You know, I have a friend in London, he's an animator, and he started this is before really Facebook took off, or not so much took off, but before Facebook became omnipotent. And he would just, like, write a blog about his cat and his dog and his house and his whatever. He never tried to sell anything. I mean, he might show, hey, look what I drew on a napkin today, but he never tried to sell anything. And it was his way of letting people know he's still alive, just in case they ever need an animator. You know what I mean? Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Dave, yeah, he's still around. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're doing this thing with Disney. Maybe I'll give him a call. As opposed to, please download my reel. You know, it wasn't like a selling pitch. It was more like, I'm still here.
Actually, just take today, the fact that you and I are doing this podcast. I knew I would have you on the podcast at some point, and I saw you post something on social last week that made me go, oh, yeah, I haven't worked out what I'm doing for the podcast yet. This cue would be great. Let's do that. And of course, this is going to bring you tons of business, and
Hooray.
And that's the and Hooray. Now the sales funnel is closed.
Yeah. Oh, well. So what are your are you allowed to name names? What are your more interesting projects these days? I mean, who are your more interesting clients? Are you allowed to say? Or
yeah, I mean, I've got well, all of our clients are interesting here. We work with a lot of different companies. Yeah, we're doing a lot of interesting work right now with ServiceMaster, who owns American Home Shield and Terminix, Merrymaids, you know, pretty much anything in home services they touch, and they experienced some pretty remarkable growth with one of their brands, and now we're trying to help them kind of take that playbook and, I can't say just make it work for the other brands, but tweak it so that it works for the other brands. That's nice. I would say the other thing that's got me kind of interested right now is less about a specific client and more that we've got some sister companies who do things in the email space. For instance, one's called Distribion, and they've got a marketing automation software for both email and social, and then another sister company that does a lot of smart analytics and SEM work. They're called Vertical Nerve. And we're starting to learn how all of our work piles on top of each other, how it's additive, how like, wow, they're doing SEO, I can give them good content, and then these guys can push it through social. And so, you know, we're starting to build that case of, I hate the word because it's always synergy, we're starting to do that. So that's fun, though, because we've always said that social media is just another tool. Right. I hate when people call us a social media agency. I think of us as a content agency. And what we're finding is that when we use all the tools in the toolkit with the same strategy, instead of it being kind of disjointed across a lot of different people's strategies, which may all be well-meaning, but they don't necessarily intersect, that really works well. So we're having a lot of fun kind of playing with our sisters and brothers and cousins right now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess with social media, you're trying to move the needle for your clients, but it's not so much you go down the wrong path, but you're not careful, it can be like a real time suck. You know, you can just like, you know, you can spend 3 days doing the most amazing thing and get like 4 likes on it on Facebook, and then.
Well, right, and then ultimately, you know, you want to drive sales, and if you've got a client who's trying to sell online, that's very measurable. If we're trying to drive people into a store, that's a little less so, and you have to find those intermediate measures like to what we were discussing before. Can we get you to sign up for an email? You know, and we still, you know, it's funny. We have a client that's been with us for years, and they have a change in leadership, and we're literally going back, or I think my folks are actually over there today, and explaining to the new head why social media even matters. Why in the world are brands on social media? You know, it, literally taking it back to the elementary. So I mean, it is, I think, like anything that is new to people, even if it shouldn't be new, something that takes a lot of work and explaining and guidance. And in the end, you have to be able to say that you're selling more product because of this or more service.
Otherwise,
it's a fun exercise, but it's not going to keep you in business.
Yeah, I mean, when we start what we do, I mean, it was very intuitive. Like, this might work, this can work, this seems to work. And, you know, we took a punt on faith, but now we're starting to get the data in. And I also think that stuff that wasn't so easily believed 10 years ago is way more believed now. Like, the idea that somebody would actually, you know, pay somebody money to quote unquote change their culture would be like seem like ridiculous. You know, we already got a culture and we already pay them. They should be glad to work here, damn it.
we're
the best. Yep. We're the best already. Why do we need you? We're already great. You know. And I actually think my culture is so fragile and so temporary and can be blown off course real quick. And so you have to be quite vigilant about that. And it's kind of, you know, we live in a world where it isn't certain anymore, if that makes any sense. It's not, you know, when we were kids, well, you got your college degree and then your MBA, you're set for life, boy. Learn how to play some golf.
Right.
Make sure you go to the right church.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's always the joke here now is that when people hit their 1 month anniversary, I ask them, are they ready for their gold watch?
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I mean, it's exciting. I mean, I think it keeps us young. I think it's kind of a, I think there's a lot of when we talk about culture things and purpose. I did this cartoon a few weeks ago. It just said passion is the new job security.
Mm.
If you stay passionate about something, you'll find a way to make it into a living. That's the only thing if that makes any sense. And
it totally makes sense.
And I think the companies that win are the ones that are in love with their product. They're in love with what they do the most. I mean, falling in love with your work is the ultimate competitive advantage, I think.
Yeah, probably not even falling in love with your product, but falling in love with what your product does for your customer.
Yeah.
And then you don't get so tied to a specific product, because we're in such a period of change in terms of technology and manufacturing capabilities, et cetera. You know, you're not about making widgets. You're about helping people save time in the day. And your widgets may do that today, and then something else does it tomorrow. That's why I think you're seeing so many great pivots in different business spaces now.
Right, because it's at the end of the day, we're all human. Therefore, all our problems are human problems. So it's not, you know, we don't have a technology problem. We have a human problem. You know, technology is indifferent. You know,
right.
Technology just makes this life less painful to navigate. But
yes.
It's kind of and you know, a good technologist knows that, so it's nothing new. I think what happens with is the old saying they teach at Harvard Business School. You know, why do the railroads go out of business? Because they weren't in the railroad business; they were in the transportation business.
Yep.
They were so in love with their business model they couldn't bear changing it, so they protected it so they had a very tough half century there.
And I think we see a lot of businesses struggling with that now too, a lot of legacy businesses. But that's probably another whole episode.
And that happens so much faster now. So.
Yeah.
Anyway,
almost before you can notice it.
Yeah. So what else we got to talk about? Why are we winding down?
Well, Hugh, we've gone long, but I knew we would, because we always get wound up, and it's probably a good thing that neither of us has a glass of scotch, or this could go on another hour. So I'm going to actually close out with we started a little tradition here. Every guest I have, and I'm doing this in an effort to get the right guests going forward. The last question is always, who are two other people who I should have on the show?
I would see if you can get him. He's a busy man. I'd try to get Jerry Colonna on.
Mm, yes.
Yeah, he's an interesting fellow. Gosh, who else? Who else is interesting? You know, I'd give Austin Kleon a ring. You know, he's the cartoonist, another cartoonist. He's got some interesting ideas about how to get your work out there. He's very good. He's got like a really he's not really a businessman. He's an artist, but he has a really good grasp of what motivates people to give you their attention, I suppose.
Well, and that's what all marketers are trying to do ultimately. So that's a good one. Cool. Well, hey, Hugh, thank you a million. Really appreciate it. It was great having you here, folks. This was Hugh McLeod of Gaping Void. If you go check the show notes on the website, you'll see lots of links to him, to his work, to his company, to some of the things that we talked about today. And we will see you next week again on the Digital CMO Podcast here on the Rainmaker.fm network. Thanks, Hugh.
Cheerio. Bye.